Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone.
And how are you this morning, Mom?
Fine. We're in the midst of winter.
Yeah,
in Iowa,
like
but that's
cold rain today. Not so nice.
Yeah. Well, if it isn't freezing, it's fine with me.
That is a good point. That's a good point. Mom lives about 25 miles down the road, and I was going to go over there the other night. It was 5 o'clock. It was drizzling, and it was 33 degrees and dropping. Decided that wasn't
you knew
such
what was coming.
Decided that wasn't such a good idea.
Yeah, you have to work around the weather here. That's the way it is.
And that's not such a bad thing.
No, it's not.
So we have a really interesting show today because we're
speaking
to two sisters who are not only both writers, they've also started a publishing company and doing all kinds of interesting things. I don't know if even in an hour we'll have time to cover everything they're doing.
Well, that's true because it really is amazing what they've accomplished already.
So their names are Elizabeth Ann Atkins and Catherine Marie Atkins Greenspan, and they come from a family of writers. Both have undergraduate degrees in English literature from the University of Michigan. Elizabeth has a master's in journalism from Columbia University, and Catherine has a master's in writing from the University of San Francisco. Elizabeth now is the author of nearly 20 books, has been a guest on Oprah, NPR, Good Morning America, and of course, now Writers' Voices. And her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Essence, Ebony, the Detroit News, for which her articles on race were nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. That's quite a distinction. Catherine is also a sought-after writer and editor whose work has led her to interviewing Nobel Prize winner Wole Soyinka, among others, and she's the recipient of many awards and grants and has taught English at the university level, creative writing, and English as a second language. And now, through two sisters writing and publishing, they help others craft and share their own stories. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Elizabeth and Catherine.
Thank you so much. That was an awesome introduction. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. So, are you both in Detroit?
No, Catherine's in New Mexico, but she's actually now in Nashville or Memphis.
I'm in Memphis right now, but I live in southern New Mexico, but I'm moving to Oregon, so...
Not in Michigan.
No.
Okay, so... It's not an easy question to ask where you're from.
No.
Since it sounds like it's constantly changing.
Right, yeah. Exactly. But I'm from Michigan. That's my home place.
So you
home base.
You both grew up in Michigan. Now, what led you to start this two sisters writing and publishing?
Well, Catherine and I love to write, and she spent 10 years working in financial services, and I was spending those years ghostwriting books for other people and writing my own books. And at one point, we just realized we were very unhappy in our individual pursuits, and it sort of came together, and we decided, let's team up and bring our unique expertise to create a company called Two Sisters Writing and Publishing. And I've been published by the major Big Five publishers, some of them, and we also were tired of trying to find an agent to shop our book around, to find an editor who wanted our book. So we said, let's take the power because of the disruption in the publishing industry that enables everybody to have access to technology to publish a book that can go global. Let's do it ourselves. So she brought her business expertise and I brought my ghostwriting experience, and we teamed up and we've published 12 books in less than 3 years, and we have 12 more about to come out.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, my.
Now, what was the first book that you published with your new company?
It was a book that I had ghostwritten before we merged. It's called Clear, Living the Life You Didn't Dream Of by Herman Williams, M.D., And it's an amazing story because he was a medical resident, 31 years old, about to become an orthopedic surgeon, and he dropped dead of cardiac arrest. Thankfully, he was playing basketball with other residents. He did CPR on him for 15 minutes, which the odds of having cardiac arrest outside of a hospital and living through it without brain damage are very small. And he just has a miracle survival story. But he couldn't become a surgeon because the defibrillator that was implanted in his chest would interfere with his ability to perform surgery. So he had to reinvent himself. So not only does he tell his gripping story, that's a love story because his fiance, who became his wife, took care of him for many years, but he also created something called the kindness scale that teaches people how to live a compassionate and fulfilling life by doing acts of kindness that can be as small as smiling at someone or as big as donating an organ.
Wow. I'll bet that's an amazing book. That's an amazing story. It really is.
Thank you. He recently spoke at the Harvard School of Public Health, and he's getting tremendous interest in his book. But very importantly, his book set the stage and the theme for every book that we do is about inspiration and people beating the odds and telling a story that can help others overcome whatever challenges they're enduring.
Now, part of the focus of Two Sisters Writing and Publishing is to promote diversity in adult literature. What is it that about you and your lives that makes this so important to you?
Well, Catherine, please jump in whenever you want. But
okay.
Our family story is very unique. In fact, my mother is about to speak at the Urban League about her story today because she wrote her book about her life that obviously set the stage for our lives. But in the 60s, our father was a Roman Catholic priest. He was English, French, and had some Native American ancestry, and he was very unhappy in the priesthood. He wanted a family. So, meanwhile, our mother was the organist in the church, and she was trying to convince him to stay. The priests, you don't leave the church. That doesn't happen. So she was trying to convince him to stay, but he said, no, I've made up my mind. So he left the church, and then they started dating. And they fell in love, and she's African-American and half Italian, but she was adopted by a Black family. And so she was 19. He was 44. The bishop said they were both going to hell because of the, priests weren't supposed to leave the church, and then there was controversy around the age and the race and the family's disapproval, and it was just a completely unheard-of scenario. But people said it wouldn't last for 24 hours, and it lasted 24 years till our father died. Meanwhile, their colorblind love instilled in me and Catherine a beautiful understanding that we don't love with our skin or our labels. We love with our hearts and our minds, and that's how we were raised. We had people in our lives, in our community, Jewish, Russian, Chaldean, Asian, Black, white, you name it. We, Native American, Daddy was very involved in the Native American community with us. And so it's a sort of a Michael Jackson song, We Are the World. And that's how we were raised, and that's what we started writing about. But at the time, there was no Barack Obama, Tiger Woods, Mariah Carey, Derek Jeter, the long list of mixed-race people that you can look up to now as a kid and say, wow, I can be like them. A mixed-race person was president. There was nobody for us, and so we had to find our own way, and we've always loved writing, and so we literally wrote ourselves into American literature. Like Catherine wrote her The Veronica series in graduate school about a biracial girl coming of age, and I wrote my first three novels about mixed-race characters, because we took our writing passion, we took our personal stories, which were sometimes painful, and we created these fictional accounts that educate and entertain at the same time.
Now, just out of curiosity, because I'm looking at the cover of your mother's book, and there's a picture of the family, and it's kind of a small picture, so I'm not seeing it very closely.
Uh-huh.
But the two of you don't look a lot alike, do you? The two sisters.
we don't really look alike. Catherine is more like Tom Jr. and I'm more like my mother. Like, if you just look at our shoes, my shoes are sparkly high heels, all different colors. Her shoes are like hiking boots and flats. So our personalities are very different as well. It's really hilarious, actually. Like,
but you you obviously have a lot in common as writers. Now, you say you come from a family of writers, or your press kit said that. So were your parents, and your mother has written her memoir, did she write other books as you were growing up?
No, she went to law school when we were little. Both parents worked full-time, and that's another unique thing about our family. She worked full-time, went to law school at night because her main objective was to get a better job and make more money so she could send us to college, because Daddy was so much older and he had a job with the state of Michigan, and it wasn't going to provide him with big bucks to send us to college when he retired, right when we turned 18. So she got to work, and their struggle, sacrifice, and teamwork, Daddy would make us dinner, he would get us to our piano lessons, he would make sure we did our homework, he would get us to bed, and then she'd get home at like 11 o'clock and then study all weekend, and our father would take us camping up north to, you know, so she could study. So their teamwork showed us that struggle and sacrifice paid off, because she became the longest serving chief judge of one of America's biggest and busiest courts, 36th District Court in Detroit. So her writing was really legal writing, but meanwhile, our father was at the dining room table every night writing in journals, in spiral-bound notebooks, chronicling the mundane and magnificent details of family life that he had so yearned for.
He also had been an English major at Notre Dame. That was what his bachelor's degree was in. And I think he started journaling in the early 60s. And it was the little steno pad with the little the spiral-bound ring on the top. And he just every day... So he was a writer, like a constant writer, but not to the point that anything was published or that he wrote short stories or anything. But our mother sat down, so she had this unique story of marrying the priest, and she was the organist. And every time someone would hear that story, they'd say, "Oh, that sounds like a made-for-TV movie," and you know, you should write about that. And she never was inspired. Her thought was, this is just my life. This isn't really that interesting. And she was never inspired. And also because she was a judge, she was somewhat of a public figure. She didn't really want that personal story out in the world. Mm-hmm. So a couple years after she retired, she just sat down one day on her computer and just set up a text edit on her computer and just started typing, and the story just poured out of her, the memories came back, and within 4 months she had written the whole thing from start to finish. So, and she doesn't consider herself a writer, but she did write her story, and then we of course edited it and formatted it and published it.
Wow, that must have been a really interesting thing to do with your mother. Were there things that you learned in this process that you didn't know before or maybe had forgotten?
Yeah, Catherine definitely has something funny to share, but our grandmother, the woman who adopted her, was really abusive emotionally and physically. And so she recounts that in the book, and that was very difficult to read. We already didn't like our grandmother because she was just always making our mother cry, and our mother again waited till she died until she wrote the story and published it. But knowing that our mother endured such horrific lovelessness was awful, and then just it to me, it instilled a new appreciation in my mother that she did so much to help us. You kind of don't really appreciate your parents fully until you grow up and see what they've done for you to make sure you have opportunities to excel in life. But people, when people ask this question of Catherine, Catherine, what's your answer?
Oh, my best friend's parents said to me, well, did you learn anything? The same, basically the same question. And I said, well, yeah, but it wasn't something I really wanted to know, but I learned how my sister was conceived. And it's not anything graphic in the book, but our mother thought it was important because our father was a priest and he'd never had a relationship with a woman. And so there, you know, it's just a small snippet of that, of the evolution of their relationship. But I think the bigger thing for me was, because our parents were so affectionate with each other. They tucked us in bed, kissed us. We told each other we loved each other all the time. So I think when I read that our grandmother never told my mother or her, they also adopted a boy who was 4 years older than my mother, who when he was 16 and my mother was 12, he was also abused and he left home because he couldn't take it anymore. And just to learn that our grandmother never told our mother or her brother that they loved her was just sort of like mind bending. I knew that there was abuse, but I just, the idea of not being able to tell your kids or hear from your mother that you're loved. Our grandfather was really affectionate. So my mother, he was sort of like the antidote to the abuse, but he didn't ever step in. He sort of let the mother run things, but he told our mother and her brother that he loved them and he was, you know, soft and gentle and loving. But I think that was the biggest thing.
You gotta wonder why in the world she would adopt kids when she obviously didn't have much maternal instinct.
Right.
Yeah, our mother asked that question all the time. She was very all about what other people thought, and she wanted to have the perfect picture of a family unit. She was a piano teacher, and she made our mother practice piano and become a concert-quality pianist and perform in recitals and wear the big frilly dresses, et cetera. And so she had her own ghost and her own pain, our grandmother.
I wonder if it has to do with the pressure of, you know, if she was unable to have children, and in that day and age where motherhood was really what the only thing women were allowed to identify themselves by, almost, it was very, very difficult to do anything else. And so she may have felt societal pressure to be a mother, even though she really didn't want to.
Mm-hmm. And then also to have perfect children, as Elizabeth said, she was a piano teacher, and so my mother had to be the star pupil, you know. And of course that's something where if your mother's a piano teacher and you practice, you know, you can't practice without being a piano lesson, you know. So there was just a lot of pressure to have the perfect children.
Well, my mother was a piano teacher too, but I never felt any pressure from you about it, Mom.
Oh, that's good.
In fact,
awesome.
Most of the time, I didn't even get the lessons I had were Mom in the kitchen fixing dinner and saying, "You played that wrong."
Oh, that's funny.
I know. But I became a passable piano player, but it was never something I was going to be good at. So it's a good thing that you didn't mind that I wasn't so good, Mom.
Well, I don't know if I ever told you you weren't very good. I mean, you know.
No, you didn't tell me that. You didn't tell me that. It was just, you know, here's how I learned that I wasn't very good. In seventh grade, the seventh grade choir, for the Christmas concert, had student accompanists for three songs, and I was supposed to accompany on one. And I was so bad at the performance. I mean, nobody told me that. Nobody made me feel bad about it, but I got lost. I was so nervous. And honestly, it's kind of a dumb idea to have your very first public performance be accompanying a choir.
Yes. I do that all the time now at church. I mean, that's what I do. And it's difficult. It really is difficult.
Yeah. And so for my first public performance.
Oh, that's so funny.
I was going to say our mother has always had a piano and she can sit down and just play like pieces that she learned back in those days. I mean, she's an amazing pianist and she's performed, you know, I think she's performed at weddings. I mean, so it did create this, in a roundabout way, it created a love for classical music and for playing the piano. I mean, she'll just, it's really joyful.
Well, not only that, but she wouldn't have become the church organist if she hadn't had that background. And so you may not have existed.
Right. We wouldn't be having this conversation.
Wow. That's interesting.
That's funny.
Yeah. Wow.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are Two Sisters Publishing, or Two Sisters Writing and Publishing. And Two Sisters Writing and Publishing is comprised of Elizabeth Atkins and Catherine Greenspan. Elizabeth and Catherine, I see on your website that you've created a program called Power Journal, I believe. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we're so excited because the workbook just went on sale on Amazon and Barnes & Noble last week. And this began as something that, this is Elizabeth talking, I've always journaled my whole life, as has Catherine, and I started meditating in 2010, and I started writing down what I would learn in my meditation. And so I innately paired journaling and meditation, and meditation has transformed my life in ways I can't even explain. But I developed this process that was tremendously healing and empowering, and it enabled me to reach tremendous goals like losing 100 pounds, which ended up enabling me to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show and manifesting other things and writing better than ever. And so Catherine and I were like, wow, we should teach this. So I started teaching it at, first I gave it a name, Power Journal. And then I started teaching it at a juice bar in Detroit every month. I would do Power Journal for weight loss, Power Journal for inner peace, Power Journal for writing your book, and a year's worth of programs. And so Catherine and I decided to take it to another level, and we created an online community at powerjournal.life, which is a website where you can do the program for 28 days. We created a 28-day challenge, and then we wrote a workbook. And that just went for sale. So we made it a 28-day challenge so you can sort of have some excitement around delving deep in yourself with these four main questions, which are, who am I? What do I want? Am I ready for change? And what do I have to do to make that change? And when I first heard those questions at a conference that I've subsequently heard Oprah and other thought leaders ask, who am I? I didn't know the answer, because the answer is not my name, my education, my career. Who I am is deep down inside me. It's my spirit. It's my purpose in life. It's what brings me joy. It's what I can contribute. And so Power Journal is a way to go within yourself and hear that inner voice unobstructed by the inner critic and all the woulda, coulda, shouldas and the fear and the doubt of oneself and really get to your authentic voice and get the clear answers, and then take action to live the life that you really, really want and create the self that you really want. And it works.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wow.
Thank you.
So have you had...
It's really...
Like, how many people have gone through this program, would you say?
Oh, okay. Well, at the ones at the juice bar, I would probably have 10 to 25 people. And then online, we just started it in July. and the Bork book just came out. So we haven't had a ton of people yet, but those who've done the questions. Oh, and I also did it at a retreat in Sedona, Arizona, a seminar. We haven't had a ton of people yet. It's a very new thing, but I am going to be doing it for a women's group in December here in Detroit. I'm really excited. So we had to get the infrastructure set up first.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the best parts of that is that it's not like 2 or 3 years going. It's how many days was it? 28 days?
28. Yeah.
Yeah. See that was really a brilliant move, I think.
Oh, thank you. And then Catherine said, let's just advertise it as just 20 minutes a day of writing in your journal can really have a tremendous impact. So it's not only just 28 days, but it's only 20 minutes a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really interesting. I have been on a very long cross-country road trip, and so I was listening to Michelle Obama's new memoir, Becoming. And there's a point, I was driving like through the state of Missouri, and there's a point in her story where she's about 25 and she starts looking at her life, because by then she had a Princeton undergraduate degree, a Harvard law degree, had a really great job at a prestigious Chicago law firm. But she's looking at her life for the first time, and she says she's not a naturally introspective person, but it was the first time she started looking at the pieces of her life and asking if she was fulfilled. So the first thing she does at this point is she buys a journal.
I love it.
Starts asking, who am I? Basically going through the concept of who am I? Because I think what we tend to do is when asked who we are, I think a lot of well, I'm a lawyer.
Right,
I went to
right.
Harvard. I did this. Uh-huh. I did that. I'm from here. Mm-hmm. These are my parents. And mm-hmm. so the whole concept of power journal is not who are you, like what's your resume say, but who are you on the inside? And then it isn't until you can stop in a 20-minute journal entry and go, okay, who am I? What do I want? Like dive deeper and then go, is my outside life in alignment with who I am on the inside? Because if it's not, usually I think what happens is people get to a certain age and then they're like, wow, I've been at this job for 20 years and I'm not exactly sure I like it, but it's hard to make a change. And the whole point in Power Journal is to do sort of a check-in to make sure what's on the outside of your life and what's on the inside of your heart and soul are in alignment. And they don't, and if they're not, it's not an overnight change. It's really sort of that introspective looking inward and making an effort, if things are not in alignment, to get them better into alignment. So I just thought it was really interesting that, you know, First Lady of the U.S., of course everything's good, you know. But it's sort of a universal concept.
Now, Mom, you've always journaled, right?
Well, yeah. Diary. Write a diary every day.
Well, that's journaling.
Yeah. Yeah, I got tons of diaries.
Do you ever go back and read through old ones and see how your life is different or what you were and surprise yourself by what you were feeling or thinking then?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, since your father died when I was teaching school and I was an aide. I didn't have a degree yet, so I had to go back and get a degree. So I did that and then taught school and 8 years later married again, a completely different life. Moved to a farm and, you know, so I had a lot of changes in my life. And I must say I was richly blessed the whole way.
Wow.
I had great parents, great grandparents, supportive aunts and uncles. And I just, you know, I just had a blessed life. No doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Beautiful.
Now, Catherine and Elizabeth, you mentioned your father having journaled all those years. Did you ever read his journals?
Yes, they were in a box in our mother's garage. And when I was 35, I read them and I learned about he baptized us in the hospital room. And I learned what he wrote the day after I was born when he baptized me. And that is it's now in my memoir, my spiritual memoir, which is coming out in January. It's called God's Answer is No, Lessons, No, K-N-O-W, Lessons mm-hmm. from a Spiritual Life. And it shows how he ordained me, he blessed me, he anointed me to be on a spiritual quest, teacher. But he never told me this. I read it when I was 35, and it's come to fruition after many life lessons learned through painful experiences. And I'm really grateful that he wrote about that day. And it was amazing to read them, really amazing. Yes.
I wondered, with your mother having written her memoir about the story, whether you ever considered crafting a memoir out of your father's journals.
I tried it years ago, and it didn't really, it's better that it worked out this way with our mother telling it, because she, it's better with her doing it.
It's actually really tricky to read somebody's journals after they've died, because as a journaler, you know what when you journal, let's say you write that you're angry with somebody, it just passes. But then to go back and read somebody else's journal about the time, November 24th, 1975, when you're having an argument.
Right.
It has no meaning whatsoever, yet because there are the words there, it has power, So it's a really delicate balance, whether or not to even read them, and then to share them is an entirely different thing.
Well, that's true, because for one thing, you don't have the opportunity to ask for permission to share.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Journaling is such a deeply personal thing. Like, I don't let anybody read my journals. I do it on a computer now, so they're all password protected. But I did journal through college, and going back and reading my journals about my struggles with weight and body image and food is just heart-wrenching. It's going in my memoir, but it's really difficult to go back and read some of the struggles you had. But it's also an affirmation to go back and see, wow, I finally, thank God, overcame that. I'm not that person anymore. So it can show you your evolution, which is pretty triumphant.
And Elizabeth has kept all of her journals, and I periodically I get rid of my journals, and several years ago, I actually created a bonfire and burned all my journals up to about 20 years ago.
Really?
for the very reason that I was not the same person that I was when I was 20, and therefore I didn't need to reread those journals. And taking it a step further, if I died, I didn't want anybody to read those. Mm. And so they served their purpose, and they didn't need to be part of the world anymore. So they're not.
I love it.
Wow.
That's funny.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are from Two Sisters Writing and Publishing, Elizabeth Ann Atkins and Catherine Marie Atkins Greenspan. Let's talk a little bit more about the publishing aspect of what you're doing. Now, you started out publishing, sounds like your own books, your mother's book, but you've branched out into other authors. What are you looking for, and how does it, if someone wanted to publish a book with you or was interested in getting published, what kind of books are you looking for, and how do you work with writers?
Catherine?
Well, I think what happened, and we didn't even set out to do this, but it's happened and it's sort of become our mission, is that a lot of the ghost writing that Elizabeth was doing was memoir, and it was for people who were retired or who, you know, were 60 or 70, so they could look back on their life. And their stories of their lives were overcoming great odds. So one book is Let the Future Begin, and it's about the former mayor of Detroit, who also served on the Michigan Supreme Court. He was born in a house in rural Michigan with no running water in the 40s. And then another book is about another memoir that Elizabeth Ghost wrote is the one of 22 children of a sharecropper born in the North Carolina in the early 30s. So, and he just was on a mission in his life. He knew from a young age that he wanted to make the world a better place. And he spent nearly 40 years with the American Red Cross and served as interim president. And he was the first person of color to do that at the American Red Cross. So I think what happened is people came to us to do ghostwriting with these really triumphant stories. And then we just said, you know, then other people would come to us with stories about corruption and you know, I don't, just like not the same thing. And we just looked at each other and said, you know, the stories of inspiration and triumph are so much more of what we want to put into the world. So based on who was coming to us, we sort of developed this concept of wanting to work with people who have inspiring stories. So that's what we're looking for. And actually we created, we have a call for submissions for 5,000 word personal essays on different themes about inspiring stories, like inspiring stories of weight loss, inspiring stories of adoption, inspiring stories of healing, cancer survival. So we're like going full steam ahead with that mission of adding more stories of inspiration to the world.
And will those, like you say, those personal essays, are they for an anthology?
Yes, they're four anthologies. So each anthology will have a specific theme and topic. Like one will be maybe 10 stories, 5,000 word personal essays on weight loss success. Mm. And then another anthology on the inspirational stories of adoption.
Wow. So, and do you have, I thought I saw maybe a short story contest as well.
After I left Michigan, I was living in San Francisco and I bought the Writer's Market and I was writing a ton of short stories and I would try and find, I would mail off stories to magazines or publications. This was before the internet. I wanted to get something published. So when we started our company, I told Elizabeth I wanted to help aspiring writers of short stories. So we started holding monthly short story writing contests on our website. And then the objective was after a year, we would put all the winning short stories into an anthology and then do that every year. So we published in July our first anthology, and it's international writers. I think there are 24 stories, and they're on different themes or genres. Like there are a few magical realism. There's a romance category, a Western, stream of consciousness. And that has been so fun. So we're at the end of 2018. So we've had contests all year long. So when we pick the winners for the December contest, we're going to take all the winners from this year and publish the second anthology of short story writers.
Wow. That does sound like
fun. Really fun.
Then how do you market those books?
We use the Ingram Spark platform, which is part of the Ingram Book Group, which of course is the biggest book distributor in the world. So all the books are available in like 39,000 retail outlets globally. And we use all sorts of social media. We use word of mouth. So that's what we do.
And Catherine's really savvy about our social media platforms, and she's always doing different campaigns on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So she's really good at that. We also have a PR firm that we have contracted with to promote us, which is very helpful, thankfully. So there's a lot. I mean, marketing is a 48-hour day job, but the most... the most powerful marketing is word of mouth. So when one person reads one of our books and says, wow, this is awesome, and they go on Amazon and do a review, or they tell their friends to read the book, then that's really powerful. And that's what happened, like, for example, a few weeks ago, Mother's Book was in a book club, and there were 15 ladies at this beautiful restaurant all sitting around the table talking about her book. So they had all purchased and read it. And it's really a delightful experience as an author to have people so interested in what you wrote that they want to get together and talk about it. So,
and we currently have almost all of our books at the moment we have a Goodreads giveaway going on for each one. So that's just so fun. I am just a big fan of Goodreads, and I just love it. Those end on December 21st, and we're going to give away five of each for each of the – we have seven books in Goodreads giveaways right now.
Oh, cool. So, you know, back to your mother's memoir, did she have any hesitation about sharing so much personal information with the world?
Yes, and as Catherine said, she waited till she was retired from being a judge, so it wouldn't draw any attention to her judicial temperament or reputation. And secondly, she waited until her mother died, so that there would be no issue of her sort of airing the dirty laundry about how mean our grandmother was, because she, of course, became this sweet little old lady once she got dementia. For later years.
It sounds really funny, but it's what happened.
You know, the funny thing is, sometimes it goes the other way, too.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow.
Someone who was very kind and sweet sometimes becomes real irascible when they get dementia.
Yeah. So that's a really important question for anyone who's considering writing their memoir. The timing is very important, because what you put out there could affect your career, your family, your reputation. In the course of writing my memoir, what do I want to say about my ex-husband, who's super sweet now, but we went through terrible times? Like, how much of that do I want to put in the book? Does it matters, because that was very formative to my independence, survival, strength of spirit. Very important to my personal development. But in the interim, how important is it to show the graphic details of it? That's a huge question to ask. What is the end result? What is the impact you're going to have?
Yeah. In your memoir, God's Answer is No, KNOW. That's such a great title.
Thank you.
Is the Power Journal tools, are they described in there as well?
Yeah. So here's the mission of this. It's to tell my story, but in order to appreciate what I'm teaching, my story enhances that. I have learned so much, and I have endured and transformed tremendously in profound ways. I am anointed, called to teach. I must teach. It's what God tells me, my spirit guide, my father's spirit tells me. I must teach what I know, because I have found ways to improve self and life. and I must teach it. Therefore, I am using my book to tell my story, but it's a teaching guide. And the second part of the book is all the how-to. So I teach people how to follow a diet that is going to enhance their mental health and physical wellness and spiritual connection. I teach people how to meditate. I teach people how to power journal, because I learned to heal my body. I can heal a migraine headache through journaling and meditation, where I used to have so many medications for migraine. I used to give myself this shot called Imitrex, like literally shoot myself in the leg with a needle to get rid of the pain that didn't even dissipate entirely for days. So I'm not advocating that anyone get off their medical regimen with their physician. That's not it at all. I'm teaching what I've learned that can help other people. So it's really, really, like, it's my calling. I must do it. And writing is scary. Like, I didn't used to be comfortable talking about God and spirit and, you know, it just, but it's my calling, and therefore I'm doing it courageously, fearlessly. And I'm really so excited to share all of this, because I've taught lots of people how to meditate, how to journal, and now power journal for wellness is in there, power journal for peace. And it's really simple. You just have to learn it and get in the groove and apply it to your life. And another message here is that it takes work. Nothing happens. You get out of it what you put into it. So I'm not perfect at all either. I still have days where I meditate and it's all fog, or days where I just feel sad, or nothing's perfect. It's all process, but you have to engage in the process with the goal of finding some improvement. And we're offering tools. We're offering tools, whether someone picks up one of our books and feels inspired, they do power journal and learn about themselves. They submit something and get published, as you know, that's a dream come true for a lot of people. So Catherine and I are just on a mission to do good in the world and helping people one at a time. And it's really so fulfilling. We like work so much, but we love it. We love it.
Well, Catherine, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the Veronica series. I think you mentioned that you started writing that when you were in graduate school.
Yes. So the very first class of graduate school was called Autobiographical and Narrative Writing. And so I wrote this short story it was autobiographical, about how my hair changed when my sister and I had long silky hair when we were little, and then it was in fifth grade that my hair, and our father had a rule for us that we couldn't cut our hair, so our hair was super long, like down to our waist, and that was great when it was silky and, you know, manageable, but all of a sudden, and it was probably like hormonal changes that caused this, my hair just turned into like this massive, thick, I mean, it was like as heavy as an Afghan. It was just, I felt like I looked like Cousin It. It was just horrible. Elizabeth's hair changed too, but hers actually had curl to it. But mine just turned thick and frizzy and heavy. Mm. So the first thing I wrote in this class was about my hair. And then that led to, well, in my mind, there was a boy in my fifth grade class who was not my friend, but one day he said to me, as I've got my Cousin It hair parted straight down the middle, he said, "Catherine, I heard your mom's black." And so it was all of a sudden, no one had ever said that to me. I had my friends knew my mother. We had our black relatives, our white relatives, but it was pure harmony and love and joy. And suddenly this boy out of nowhere says to me, "I heard your mom's black," like an insult. It was like, what? I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to process it. I had no idea. Like, okay, what am I, like, part of me wanted to punch him in the face And then part of me wanted to like run and hide, but I had no, I had nothing in, inside my brain that told me how I should process this. And I didn't go to my parents and tell them this because I didn't want to insult them. It was so very confusing. And in my mind, it was the change in my hair that triggered the world, this sense of the world looking at me differently. Like my hair was like this big thing saying I'm different from everybody else. Mm. And so that was the beginning of the Veronica books, because what I did is I wrote a couple more autobiographical pieces. And then for my master's thesis, I turned them into fiction. So the Veronica character looked like me. The first book is called Veronica, I Heard Your Mom's Black, and it actually has that same, she goes through that experience and tries to figure it out. But then she has all these fictional experiences that I never had. And, but then so then when we started our publishing company, I took my thesis and I turned the two books that I wrote in grad school into three books. And the third book is actually something that I experienced as a 22-year-old on Cape Cod, and I put Veronica into that same sort of scenario, but she's 15 in the book. So it all is like from me, but it's not really about me.
Okay. All right.
Like, yeah. And by the way, my father knew how miserable I was with my hair, so I had a chin-length bob by the time I was in 11th grade.
Well, now, the funny thing is, my dad wanted to make me cut my hair, and I wanted it long.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You remember that, Mom?
No, I don't remember that he wanted you to cut it.
He wanted me to cut it because he thought that it would make me vain. That my hair, that I was vain about it. And apparently his sister, who he did not get along with very well, spent a lot of time preening in front of the mirror and he didn't want me to be like that. And and it was the only time, and I was in tears because at the time, I think I was probably about 14, my hair was the only thing about me that I thought was pretty. And I told Mom, and you probably don't remember this, but this is the only time I remember my mother standing up to my father.
Well, I didn't do it very often.
No. But you did it for me.
Wow.
You did it for me, so he didn't make me cut my hair.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about it was, you know, when I look back on it, that there's a lot of talk about how girls get at a certain age, they feel like that society only values you for your appearance, and and I definitely, I'm turning 60 in a couple of weeks, so at the time that when I was growing up, that probably was pretty true, that where girls, the appearance was such a big thing, but it wasn't in my house. And I never, now the downside of that is that I never felt like I was pretty because no one ever said anything about that. But the upside is it that I learned to be valued. I was valued for my intelligence, for my competence, for my helpfulness, for my kindness, for all the things that really you should be valued for.
That's really important. And Catherine and I feel very strongly about showcasing strong women and setting that example in the books that we publish. So we do that as well.
We talked earlier about diversity, hearing diverse voices in publishing. Why do you think that this has been, more attention has been paid to this in children's literature than in adult literature?
There's this whole, like, we need diverse movement. I mean, we need diverse book movement. And I think it's because parents are realizing that
that kids need to have positive influences regarding diversity and acceptance of others from a ridiculously young age. Like, it's not something when a kid goes away to college or is in high school that conversation can begin. And I that's really what I think it is. It's parents are realizing that in order to teach their kids the value of diversity, that it needs just to be introduced, like, the same time they're learning to read. They need to be reading about. Well, and another thing is that a lot of that people need, kids need to see that even if they're different from other people, they're really not. And I think we learn this, we learn that our differences are, we're really, you know, we're all human beings and we all have the same struggles, but certain differences don't really have an impact. And I think people realize that as adults. Mm. And I just think of the, of South Pacific. Do you remember that, the movie, South Pacific, or maybe the play?
Was that the one, I gotta wash this man right out of my hair?
Yes, it was.
Yes.
The white American military guy is on this island, and he meets this woman. And what I remember is that the concept of racism and otherness and we're different and one is better or worse than the other, the song is something about being carefully taught. Like, you have, like, kids are taught that from their parents. You don't know, kids just aren't born naturally thinking different is bad.
Right.
So the concept is if parents can teach their kids without even teaching them and through books, that's there's so much learned through books as kids, that if kids can read a book about, you know, let's say a white kid reading about a black kid, it's just a kid having a kid experience. It's not about this kid is different from you. It's like opening the mind to the fact that we're all the same. And I think parents realize that the kids need to be exposed to that as young as possible. And that's, I think, why there's a push for needing diverse books. So there are a lot of like little kid books, but I don't know about like the Veronica type books of any,
no.
Of like a multiracial teenager, you know, having a normal experience. It's sort of like the way that Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was for me as a kid, because Margaret was half Jewish, and there's nothing in the book about this being anything other than I'm slightly different from everybody else, but really all we care about is boys and boobs and, you know, it's like,
yeah.
But I think that for me is, that's what it is for me. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time, and it's been a great pleasure to talk with you, Catherine and Elizabeth.
Yeah, we could talk for another hour. Well, you could talk for another hour.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Well, I have a lot of them, but I was just, we're all part of the world, and if we can contribute kindness and goodness, that is the most important thing. And I think you two ladies are doing that, and that is momentous. It really is.
Thank you.
Wow, thank you.
Wow.
Well, thank you both so much, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.